I'm Floyd Hall, and this is a Wonder Root Artist feature. I have the pleasure today of talking with artist, trumpeter, musician extraordinaire, Joey Somerville. Joey, how you doing?
I'm wonderful, Floyd. I'm happy to be here.
I'm happy to have you in. What's new in your world right now?
Let's see. I've been traveling all of 2013, a lot of out-of-town stuff on the road, which is a wonderful, gainful employment is a wonderful thing. Just got back from the Capital Jazz Super Cruise. That was Dominican Republic and Aruba and Curacao, and it was great. It was like a week of nonstop music and shows. And headed in the studio, back in, working on a new album. I got some great collabs that I'm doing, working with Jeff Lorber, amongst other people, DJ Kemet, on and on and on, just having a good time and just really, 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 really happy to be doing what I'm doing.
How much are you on the road?
Well, from my perspective, from my world, most of my shows are on the weekends. So Thursday through Sunday. But I'm not usually like gone on a tour bus for a long stretch of time. So I'm in and out, and which is cool, because it's still, the travel still can be, for the most part, it's fun to get on a plane and go someplace to go play your music and make some people happy. So weekends.
When did you know that the trumpet was your calling?
I knew that I wanted to do music.
Okay.
When I was probably a freshman in high school, I decided that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to do music as a vocation, as a career, as my primary life's work. I started playing the trumpet when I was in the fifth grade, and I still play. You know, I play trumpet as my principal instrument, but I also play piano. I sing a little bit. I write. I arrange, produce, on and on and on. So all of those things are part of what I do. People know me more so than anything as Joey, the trumpet player. But that's the face of what I do. It isn't the all of what I do from a musical perspective. And it's not all that I want to do. In fact, I derive a great deal of pleasure out of, writing music and recording and producing that and all the other stuff that goes behind the scenes, as opposed to it's my show, it's my record, that kind of thing.
So what don't we see? I think when an audience looks at a performer on stage, such as yourself,
they don't see the grind.
Okay. Talk to me about the grind.
The grind is what gets you to be able to be on stage in front of people. It's the rehearsal, which is not like rehearsal. I actually enjoy rehearsals. I mean, but you gotta do rehearsal, learning songs, learning the craft, learning how to play the instrument, the shedding, practicing of it. The travel, the phone calls, the business, the sacrifices that you make, from a financial perspective, you have to sacrifice in order to advance as an artist. Generally, dues are paid, period. And I don't care who it is you see. It may look like, oh, well, they're just like, they're balling out of control. No, they had to do some suffering along the way to get from point A to point C,
How was Atlanta as a jazz city compared to other, I guess, traditional jazz cities like a New Orleans or a Charleston or other places like that?
New Orleans is a special place. New Orleans is the culture of New Orleans is, every other kid on the corner plays an instrument. Music is part and parcel of the culture. New Orleans is very different than any place else that I know of, in terms of the culture of that city. That city has an old, established culture. Atlanta as a jazz city. It's interesting because Atlanta, if you go on a national or international level, people think of Atlanta primarily as a hip hop town, you know, in terms of music. But there is so much diversity to the music community here in Atlanta. It's amazing. There's people in, you know, and I mean like world class jazz musicians. There's world class, you know, classical, the Atlanta Symphony, the ASO. There's country artists. There's artists from almost every genre you can think of who make their home here. And there are pockets of folks that gravitate to various and sundry kinds of music here. But Atlanta isn't really known, per se, as a jazz town. I think that's just a function of just pop culture and how it just I don't think that we, as, and when I say we, I mean Atlanta, the Atlanta music community does a very good job of marketing the diversity of the Atlanta music scene. I think that the hip hop community has done a tremendous job of marketing the fact that, you know, that hip hop is arguably the capital, certainly the southern outpost of hip hop. I mean, and if you look at it, when you look at, say, the AMAs or Grammys or what have you, a lot of nominees are from here. You know, there's a lot of music made here. But if you look across the category, as far as Grammys are concerned, you know, if you look across categories, there's nominees from a ton of different categories outside of hip hop. Yet the popular conception is that Atlanta is a hip hop town, and that's it.
So if that's the perception outside of Atlanta, locally within the city, the metro area, are those bridges being built between the different genres and those artists? Is there respect there? Is there awareness? Where is the sort of intra-city collaboration between the artists from all of these different genres?
That's a very, very interesting question. I serve on the board of governors for the Recording Academy for the Atlanta chapter, which is, the Recording Academy is the entity that produces the Grammy Awards and gives out the Grammy Awards. And that's just part of what the Recording Academy does. Now, I will say that through all the associations of folks that I've met through the Academy and brought into the Academy, that there is that whole, there's definitely, I've seen nothing but mutual respect from people from different genres through that are involved in the Recording Academy, as far as, cause real artists, respect other real artists. And you can look at that. It doesn't matter what your particular niche or genre is. Game recognized game. You know, that's period. And there definitely is a respect for that I've seen for what people do. As far as collaborations are concerned, yeah, those things happen, you know, here and there, but they're few and far. But they're more few and far between than I think they should or could be. And I think that that's just a function of people not necessarily thinking about stepping outside of the box. But it does. I mean, it does happen. And I think with various degrees of success, I think it's cool when you see people stepping across the aisle, if you will, and embracing each other's vibe and coming up with a new combination of you know, it's like, it's cool to have somebody from the world of, you know, country or whatever, because and really when it gets right down to it, there's more similarities between the different genres of music than there are differences. If you listen to, I mean, I can speak from a jazz perspective. The difference between jazz and bluegrass is the instrumentation and, by and large, that's about it. You know, like stylistically, there's subtle differences, but I'm recording a new record. I used a guy on guitar from Knoxville who is a great guitar player. And he plays a lot of jam band stuff, but he's actually considers himself more of a bluegrass and country guy, but he's a blazing guitar player. He's amazing. And he doesn't consider himself a jazz player, but you put him on a song with a jazz rhythm section, and he, all of a sudden he's a jazz player because they're that similar in terms of the underlying principles of it. Music is music. It's either good or it's bad. You know, you like it or you don't.
Yeah. So looking at jazz currently as it relates to the current landscape of music, more so music distribution. When I look at the landscape, especially in hip hop, I see a heavy mixtape culture. I see a lot of independent artists who are finding a lot of different ways to be successful, whether it's YouTube or SoundCloud or having a multi-platform presence. In jazz, it seems, and probably incorrectly, that the stereotype is still of this older model, this older, or I guess more traditional way of still doing things in jazz. As a jazz artist, when you see the evolution and the digital revolution that has occurred in music, how do you perceive that for your own particular type of music?
I think that your analysis of the status quo and the way things are it is pretty spot on, in that there are a lot of jazz artists, and I can speak more from the perspective of contemporary jazz artists, that are getting up to speed with the digital revolution. And I consider myself one of those people who is dealing with it, but not as and I'm striving to be more effective with it, with the whole, you know, with Facebook, with Twitter, with Instagram, with YouTube, with all of these vehicles that are necessary for communicating with fans. And the challenge, I think, comes in a lot of times jazz artists have an older core demographic. And so some of those people are not up to speed with social media, so on and so forth. A lot of them are, a lot more than people think. And I think that by and large, jazz artists are starting to realize that. And I say jazz artists, that's sort of like, that's really a big, broad pool of folks to lump everybody into. But I think that that's the way of the world for artists, periods, whether you're hip hop, jazz, whatever. It is now an independent artist game, and you sink or swim based on your ability to adapt and adopt and really sort of play the hand that's dealt. Because if you go to the traditional model of the music industry, and particularly the distribution model, it's a wrap. That's yesterday's news. You can't find a record store. It's like, you know, it's like there are few and far between. You've got, you know, your hardcore independents that are holding out, and you know, bless them, but there are few and far between. You can't go to Target or, you know, to go to a retail proposition. The bricks and mortar version of music distribution is pretty much over. So then if you look at radio, terrestrial radio, particularly from a jazz perspective, it used to be, when I was doing the series, we talked about the Sambuca series. When I was doing that series, we started that in 2007. Well, in 2007, there was a major commercial jazz station, WJZZ, here with, you know, I don't know, 150,000, 100,000 watts, whatever, huge listenership and coverage. You know, top 10 in Arbitron ratings. And we had a partnership with them and the ability to put on commercials to advertise the shows. Well, take that out. That radio station doesn't exist anymore. And that is true across in most major metropolitan areas across the country that used to have commercial jazz stations, for better or worse. And that's a whole nother, topic, but though there was a presence, a mass media presence to distribute information about shows. And if you had a record, you know, something new coming out, if they played it, that information got to people relatively smoothly and pretty reliably. If you put on ads for a jazz show on a major station in a major metropolitan area, you're probably going to reach the people that need to hear about the show, and you'll have a reasonable, you got a reasonable chance of a successful turnout. Well, take that out of the equation, and that changes the culture. That changes the way things are done. So that is part of it. The change in the distribution model, the change in and buying habits of people. CDs are an archaic format, particularly if you talk to a younger demographic, somebody who's under 30. Why they don't buy CDs? I mean, by and large. And they're very comfortable with downloads and in whatever format. And a lot of times the downloads are free. They're used to getting music for free. So that revenue stream is by and large gone. And so as an independent artist, you have to figure out how, but you still need, it's sort of a catch 22 in that you still release music because you have to keep putting out music because that's what you do. If you're an artist, you do your art. And also people want to hear it, but they don't necessarily want to pay for it. But you need them to hear it in order to get them to be willing to pay for a ticket to come to a show. And live performance is still the primary income stream for most independent artists.
And I think that you have hit on a very interesting point, because with hip hop, or rock and roll, but I'll stay more so with hip hop. With the advent of the mixtape culture that is prevalent right now, you can give away the music, but that may be the primary way that they will ever interact with that music, because they may not ever get to a show. The person who's putting out the music may not put on a great live show. I think the live element of jazz still is a more important component, or as much of a component as the actual recorded version.
Oh, absolutely. From a jazz perspective, you haven't heard it until you've heard it live. And there is, and I've had this, throughout my career, I've had people who have come up to me and said, I don't like jazz, but I really like what you do. I thought I didn't like jazz. And they come to a live show and they go like, wow, this is cool. It's like it's an immediate, it's a visceral music, and it's never the same. That's the thing about it. It's like one of the biggest paradigms in the world of jazz is the element of improvisation. That's part of jazz music. You are making it up as you go along. So by definition, not going to be the same. I have never played the same song exactly the same way. It just does not happen. You may play the same song from one night to the next, but you're going to flip. Something is going to be different about how you're doing it. And that's part of that's what keeps the music fresh. And that's also what keeps people coming back for shows, because they know, even if they've seen you before, it's not going to be the same. You're going to do something different.
So coming to a Joey Somerville show, what will I experience?
You're going to have a good time. You will experience you will feel it. My background, I grew up playing in church. That's when and there's really not a whole lot of difference for me between the musical energy that happens in a church service and the musical energy that happens when I'm doing a show, because it's the same. To me, it's all the same thing. It's that whole, I call it soul communication, that whole spiritual essence where I'm trying to establish a vibe and a presence and a thing in this room and make this experience happen so that, the room gets lifted. And so I have a set list, which is, where you write down what songs you're going to play, and I give it to the band and go, we're going to play X, Y, Z, da, 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 da. We're going to play these songs tonight. and we're going to play them in this order. And I have yet to do a show where that set list is the truth, because I change the order of the songs. I change what songs based on what's going on in the energy of the room. I'm reading the crowd. You know, it's sort of like a football game where a quarterback comes up to the line. They got a play called and they're going to run, you know, going to run the foot. But he's looking at the defense and the way they're setting up, and he calls an audible at the line because he's recognized something that's happening there, and they're going to change what they're going to do. I do the same thing live, and all of the time I'm trying to find where this room is, where the people are in this room, what they need to hear at this point in time to lift this audience and to lift this room. And so, you know, it's kind of funny for me, because it's not really an intellectual process, to a large extent. I'm just going off the feeling and the vibe. And so when you ask me what's it like, it's an experience. It's a whole thing. And when you come, you will understand what I'm talking about. You will feel it. And afterwards you go like, oh, okay, I got it. That's what he's talking about. Because the Holy Ghost is going to come.
With a lot of artists that we get a chance to talk to, and I'm looking at visual artists, or I'm looking at sculptors, or even writers, a lot of them talk about finding their voice as an artist, where you find what your voice is. For you, what is that process like?
I never had made a point of, when I was coming up, I tell a lot of younger players this: if you are the best, see, people are like snowflakes. There's no two alike. And musicians, I'm thinking, you know, particularly, if you play music, you have a voice as a musician. You have to, you know, you have to develop it. You have to find it sometimes, and sometimes it's just there. It is there. You just have to get out of the way sometimes and let yourself be yourself. But for me, I've never had a problem with that, because I never was distracted by wanting to be anything other than Joey. And so, which has served me in that, you know, folks, you know, that are familiar with what I do, when they hear something, you know, they hear me on a record or whatever, they know it's me. It's like, no, that's Joey, because it don't sound like anybody else. I don't, you know, and I never tried to, which is a good thing. I'm real cool with that. So I never struggled with that, with that finding out who I was type of thing. That never really was a challenge for me. And I've always had a thing that was my thing, and continue to, you know, and that evolves, and you grow as an artist, you know, and you add, and your life experiences add to what you're able to draw on emotionally, and feelings that you're able to impart, and emotions that you're able to communicate through music. But I never struggled with the, I can't find my voice. And that never was an issue for me.
A lot of artists will also go back and look at their older work, their older writings, their older paintings, and they can tell how they've grown as an artist in that regard. When you go back and listen to some of your older works, can you do the same thing?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, I'm going through that process right now. I'm doing a new album next year, and the title of the record is going to be Overnight Sensation. And it's sort of, I'm pulling some stuff from the archives, some stuff that I did like in the early 90s. I have like the 2-inch masters, going back and listening to that stuff, and actually taking some of that material and including it in the new record, along with stuff that I've done, you know, that I'm doing now and have done in the past year. And so hearing the, you know, where I was in 93 and where I am, you know, as an artist in 2013, it's very, it's interesting, But I will say that there's a consistency there of who, you know, who I am as a musician and as, you know, from a songwriting perspective, but also listening to it, there's a whole lot that I've learned and incorporated in that 20 year span.
Right. Because I'm trying to imagine you listening to that version of yourself. And I'm wondering, what do you hear? Because as someone from the outside looking in, the music may sound, it just may be a different song. But for you as the artist, what do you hear in that earlier version of yourself? Or what do you hear in the current version of yourself that you don't hear from those earlier recordings?
I think maturity in terms of arrangements, things like that. It's above, it's outside of the you know, just the trumpet player part of it. I think from a songwriting perspective, you know, I think I've developed, you know, my craft more from that perspective. And also, I listen to certain things, some of the older stuff, where I go, I probably would have left that out. The economy of communication, for me, I've learned to say more with less over time, and I can hear that listening to the older stuff. Like, you know, some of that is extra. Some of that is like, you said four things when you could have said one and gotten the same point across. So that's one thing that I hear definitely. As a player, I hear the consistency of the voice. And so it's like, if you listen to, and you listen to Charlie Wilson now and listen to Charlie Wilson from Gap Band days, and the voice pretty much is still, you know, it's consistent and it's still the same. You know, I'm sure. And in fact, I saw his show. I just did the Capitol Jazz Cruise about a month ago. It hadn't even been a month. And he did his show, and the economy of movement and the ability to say more with less was cool, because Charlie Wilson is a veteran, you know, performer, and the stuff that he may have done 20 years ago, he's learned that he doesn't have to do. He can get it done with a lot less rigmarole and conniptions. You know, straight to the dome, boom, this is what it is, and getting the point across.
Away from the stage, away from the studio, who is Joey Somerville? I know you like cars.
I'm hardcore. Yeah. I'm hardcore when it comes to cars, but away from the stage, away from the studio, I'm pretty much my nickname when I was a kid is Jokey Joe. That's what my family used to call me when I was a little kid. So I have fun. I'm not a very, you know, by nature, serious, like, type. Yeah, I like to, you know, like to hang out, I like to have fun. I don't go out. My idea of fun is driving up going up to the mountains, and you know, the Georgia Mountains are probably an hour and a half from downtown Atlanta. Going up to the mountains, just driving around. I don't particularly go out a whole lot. I have to go out to shows. As part of, you know, my real life thing. So I'm going to a show. The last thing I want to do on a, you know, when I'm just downtime is go to yet another show. It's like, so I lay back, you know, but I like, as far as hobbies are concerned and stuff like that, it's really, you know, I take my cars, you know, I go to drive at Road Atlanta, and there's a track up in Dawsonville called Atlanta Motorsports Park. Where I go to drive, and that's like I have no delusions of being a race car driver, but I enjoy going to auto, you know, to sports car races, and I enjoy driving my cars fast on a racetrack, but not necessarily in a competitive. Because see, then it becomes it goes beyond hobby, because the guys that are race car drivers, they're you know, they're sweating the last tenth of a second around the track, and that's the difference between first and second place. And like, it becomes very, very, very serious and very, very competitive very quickly. That's not fun for me. I just like, you know, I like motoring. I like, you know, like I could get in a car, and I like older cars. When I say old, I don't mean like, you know, 1920s old. I mean, you know, 60s, 70s, that kind of old, and older sports cars. And I enjoy, you know, I've never met a car that I didn't want to do something to. Like, always want to change this. Oh yeah, it's a great car, but if they had just changed the sway bars on it, it would be even better, and that kind of thing. It's kind of like I need to be in a 12-step program.
Well, Joey Somerville, we talked about social media and digital media earlier. So let all of our listeners know where they can find you in all of those social media platforms out there.
Okay. Now, if you go to hit my website, that's the first spot. It's JoeySomervilleLLE.com. I am on Facebook, Joey Somerville on Facebook. I am on Twitter at Joey Somerville, JoeySomervilleLLE. I am on Instagram. Is there something else I forgot?
YouTube.
Yeah, I got a YouTube channel too. Yeah.
Okay. I think Vimeo as well.
Vimeo.
You are very well covered.
I'm trying to come correct. Doing the best I can. I got a little help. Thank you, Aaliyah.
Joey Somerville, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Floyd. It's been a pleasure.